Okay, I'd like to begin by just going a little bit over what we were talking about at the very end of the class last time. That was a bit rushed in running through this set of ideas about what renders this class a class in sociology. What is the kind of anchor for a sociological approach to studying society? At least within the type of sociology which I work in, this key idea is the notion that a society consists of a very complex interacting set of rules, and that rules govern our actions. Well, I'm not going to repeat everything I said. Here's the list of six. I want to just emphasize the last three. Number four is that rules are backed by power. So rules can be just innocent. We have rules of the road, for example, that we in the United States drive on the right-hand side of the road. In England, they drive on the left-hand side of the road. And it's pretty important to know what the rule is. If any of you have been to England, you'll notice when you hit a crosswalk, there's a big sign on the pavement in many intersections that says, "Look right." And the reason is lots of people from the continent will be in England, and naturally when you're crossing you look in the direction that you're used to, because those rules have become internalized as habits. And if you look left and the car comes from the right and you get hit, it's because your internalized rules aren't in sync with the rules of England. Well, those are pretty innocent rules. Nobody objects to having a general rule in society that you drive on one side or the other of the road. Obviously, if we had no rules about where you drive, life would be incredibly hazardous. You know, you'd be constantly dodging vehicles. And there are places in the world where it's pretty hazardous. The rules of the road are not that well enforced and not well internalized on the part of drivers. So some rules really don't have biases. They don't really affect one group or another. But many rules have consequences for the lives of people in which they favor the interests of some over the interests of others. Now, when you have rules of that sort, you can imagine that people who are harmed by the rules would object. They might find something inappropriate about a rule that consistently puts them at a disadvantage. That was certainly the case, for example, in the rules around racial relations in the United States that we've had historically. In the Jim Crow era, before the civil rights movements of the 1960s, in that era, there were rules in parts of the country, indeed in much of the country, that systematically made life more difficult for African Americans. That was part of the structure of rules of our society. Some of them were legal. In the South, there were enforced segregation, black and white drinking fountains, black and white bathrooms. I recommend, by the way, this new movie that's just come out called Hidden Numbers, about three African American women who played a very important role in the early space program in the United States. And one of the really interesting moments in that movie is when one of these African American women gets promoted to deal with a set of mathematical problems that none of the white employees know how to deal with, but she does. So she gets moved from what was called the color computing room to the white computing room. She's the only African American person in that room, but all the colored bathrooms are in another building. And so she has to spend 20 minutes getting to the building whenever she has to use the bathroom. Well, that's a rule enforced. And that clearly harms some people. No doubt about it. I mean, to say, well, that's just a neutral rule just doesn't cut it in the world in which we live today. There are winners and losers. Well, why do those rules stay stable? If somebody is harmed by a set of rules, what keeps those rules in place? Well, it's because the rules are backed by power. And that's a key idea, and that's an idea which is going to run throughout this course. We will observe rules that create problems, And one might ask, why don't we change the rules? Well, it's because those who are advantaged by the rules have disproportionate power to protect those rules. That's what makes a system stable. Systems get unstable when there's a disjuncture between power relations and the nature of the rules. That's one of the ways in which systems become unstable and become changeable. So, number four, rules are backed by power. They just don't stay in place out of inertia. Now, some rules do. A lot of our rules that have to do, that could be called customs or manners, they pretty much stay in place because they're convenient, they're internalized, there's nobody particularly harmed by them. A lot of our rules are self-perpetuating in that way. They're still rules, they still are backed by enforcement. If you violate manners, there are consequences. But there's no one that has an interest in changing the rules, and there's no strong structures of power that enforce the rules. They just continue. But that's not true for lots of the rules, and certainly many of the rules we'll be discussing in the class this semester. Okay, that's number four. Rules are backed by power. Just keep that in mind as we think about different social issues in trying to understand American society. The fifth point, I think, is one of the most interesting, and it's one of the points which you can really think about in your own lives. All the ways in which the rules that govern our behavior are inconsistent, which pull you in different directions. And as I mentioned, that's an especially acute form of that issue centers around gender. It's one of the reasons why there's so much controversy around gender issues, including on campus. A lot of the issues that center around sexual behavior, sexual aggression, sexual harassment, part of the issue there is the transformation of the character of how different rules in different communities intersect and interact, which leads to lots of tensions and people just not knowing what to do in particular situations. The whole discussion around no means no, for example, around sexual interactions, that's an attempt to make an explicitly new rule, right? No means no is a rule. Well, if no means yes, that's a very different rule from no means no. And the need to make an explicit rule reflects the fact that the rules are no longer so stable. People don't always have the same mutual understandings about what they are supposed to do and how they're supposed to behave. When rules are inconsistent, and when the power relations that back rules become disorganized, that is the situation in which rules can change. Sometimes rules change just by drift. They just sort of change behind the backs of people. No one deliberately set out to change certain rules, but they just erode over time. Their purposes perhaps become less important. People are less diligent in enforcing them, and the rules just erode over time. That's a lot of the ways in which manners change over time, and various kinds of customs about just how you interact in social spaces with other people. They change, in a sense, behind the backs of people, because people don't really notice that something is happening and that the rules are changed. Those are very interesting contexts when rules change surreptitiously behind your backs. And we've observed a lot of that also in recent years. We'll talk about that in a number of classes during the semester. But the more significant thing, well, more significant for certain purposes, is that rules change over time because people want them to change. And they engage in strategies to change the rules. Both the legally enforced rules, we call them laws, and the informal rules of everyday life. People struggle to change rules. When I say that the third task of this course is understanding the ways in which we can make life in the United States a bit better, we can improve the character of American society, not just take it as a given, not just describe it, not just examine how it works, but figure out how to make it better. When we figure out how to make it better, a lot of what's in play in that context is figuring out how to change the rules and figuring out how to do so consciously, deliberately, and strategically. That will be one of the major themes throughout the semester. All right, that's last lecture. Today's topic. Well, what kind of a society is this? There are three steps in answering this question. First, we have to figure out what are the main dimensions in terms of which societies vary. How are we going to go about answering this question? Well, we have to know what are the relevant criteria in which you can distinguish one kind of society from another. What are the dimensions on which societies vary? And there's huge numbers of dimensions. When you think about, just think about a different topic altogether. You're wandering around in a new place and you see an animal you've never encountered before. And you ask the question, what kind of critter is this? How do you go about answering that? Well, if you had no scientific theory whatsoever about animals, right, you might decide to classify them by whether they're cute or ugly. You know, you could have a warm and fuzzy category and an ugly and annoying category. And you would say, aha, I've just bumped into a really cute animal. Before we had scientific understandings of how to classify animals, there were all sorts of classification errors. Whales and dolphin were called fish, right? They swam in the sea. We had a category of a way of dividing creatures in which we had those that walked on land and those that swam in the sea. Dolphins were obviously fish. They kind of look like tuna, more or less. They were fish. Well, we know now they're mammals. To say that dolphins are mammals and to use that classification means that we have a scientific account of how animals vary in salient ways that tell us something about their inner workings, tells us something about their evolutionary history, where they are in the complex structure of evolutionary distinction and development, and it tells us something about their form and structure and properties. Evolutionary biology creates an incredibly sophisticated and interesting classification system. So does chemistry and geology. You find a new rock. Oh, what kind of a rock is this? What kind of a rock? Well, geologists, with the help of chemists, will give you a very elaborate way of classifying rocks. Well, that's the task for society. What kind of society is it? We have to figure out the dimensions. Then we have to figure out what are the categories or types on each dimension. Not enough to say this is a dimension on which we will evaluate what kind of a society we have. We have to know what that dimension means. What are the different forms or variations on any given dimension? And then we apply that schema to a particular country, the United States. Well, we could easily come up with a list of 100 attributes, dimensions, properties that we would be interested in. Here's the list that I discuss in the book. There are 10 of them. You can ask of any society what kind of technology is dominant in it, what's the character of its economy, how much inequality is there, what's the forms of inequality, how should we think about its, how should we evaluate or describe its political institutions, what's the role of the military in the society, gender relations, social cleavages of various sorts. Immigration, that's a nice way in which countries vary over time and place. Very interesting and complex category, culture. And then a very specific issue, which I think is relevant for understanding how the United States varies from other countries that in other respects are rather like it, the role of violence and repression in the society. But this is just a list of 10. It's a list that I think is particularly important for understanding what kind of society this is, and it's particularly important with respect to those moral issues which I raised at the beginning. Remember, we have 5 values that we are going to be examining in terms of American society, and these are all issues that are pretty important for understanding those values: freedom, prosperity, efficiency, democracy, and fairness. These are dimensions in which you look at a society that help us examine the ways in which those values are effectively or ineffectively realized in the development of our institutions. But there are many other kinds of dimensions. Many other dimensions can also certainly be used to evaluate and describe and understand American society. Before we go through our list of 10, I'd like us to just have a very brief discussion, 5 minutes or so, just thinking about other dimensions. And here's my proposal. It's also a way for you to get to know some of the other people in the class. Just quickly turn to the closest one or two people around you. And if you're across from an aisle and you have to scoot to do it, just talk to somebody. Find somebody right in your immediate vicinity. And for 3 minutes, come up with other dimensions besides these 10. I'll time it so that we don't spend more time. You just discuss it, and then I'll ask for suggestions from the floor, okay? Find somebody and start talking. Get close, and if you have to get up to scoot, scoot. Okay, that wasn't quite 3 minutes, but I think it's enough to get the juices flowing. Suggestions from the floor. What are some other dimensions? Yeah.
Education.
Education. Good. We could look at different countries and ask both about the levels of education, the kinds of education, where their education, how it's structured, how egalitarian is the system of education. That's one theme we'll be discussing at one point. We'll look at how unequal is the access to different kinds of education for the people in different places. And some countries do much better than others in that respect. OK, education is a good additional dimension. Another suggestion. Yeah?
Health and healthcare.
Health and healthcare, absolutely. Health and healthcare. Societies differ wildly in how healthcare is provided. We'll be discussing that when we look at the economic system, and I'll be treating healthcare as one example of how we produce and deliver a particular service. That's what an economy is. An economy are all the institutions that shape the way in which goods and services are delivered to people. Or if you want to use a broader term, provisions, social provision occurs in a population. And healthcare is certainly one example. So that will be something we'll look at, but I've subsumed it under economic structure. But there'd be good arguments for why, if you really want to understand a healthcare system, it's much broader than just the economy. It has to do with all sorts of other aspects of a society that organize the way in which people get access to healthy conditions of life, not just healthcare provision. Other dimensions? Yeah.
Religion,
sure, absolutely. Now, I've tucked that into culture, and there's a reason for doing that, but there's also good reason why a person might want to say, no, religion has sufficient weight on its own that it's not just an aspect of culture, although it is also an aspect of culture, surely. I mean, nobody would deny that religion is part of our culture. But there could be good reason for some purposes to say, no, that's not doesn't foreground it enough. We really want to understand how different societies vary on the dimension of religion, which would include what religion is dominant, or what's the distribution of religion, what's the nature of conflicts or tolerance, you know, how do we understand the interconnections and the interrelations among different religions, the problem of religiosity, which isn't just the same as what religion is dominant, how much does it pervade social life, or how much is it cabined in its own little sphere. These would all be issues that you would look at if you wanted to compare societies on that dimension. Other ideas? Yeah?
Role of the media?
Media, absolutely, sure. We'll be, that's where I've tucked that in to the course is in democracy, because there are many other aspects of the media. Media systems vary in all sorts of interesting ways that have nothing to do particularly with democracy. For the purposes of this course, I felt that the most important way in which we could think about the media in America and its particular dilemmas would be to see how it connects to the problems of democracy. Other thoughts? Yeah?
Population density?
Yeah, absolutely. Very important issue. And more generally, what's sometimes called demographic issues. But population density would be one very important issue. There's a very big difference living in a country like the United States, which, although we are the third largest in population in the world, we have very low population density overall. There are parts of the country, vast areas, where you can go and only occasionally see another person. Imagine the difference between living in a country like the United States and living in a country like Singapore. That's a real country. I mean, it's a city. It's a city state. But it has all the machinery of a real country. And it is. I mean, I don't mean it's like a real country. It is a real country. Incredible population density. There's apparently, I'm told, a rivalry between Singapore and Hong Kong on the following very interesting indicator. What's the average height above street level that a person lives in a country? And that's an interesting consequence of population density. Both Hong Kong and Singapore are vertical cities. I think Hong Kong wins at this point, that the average person in Hong Kong lives higher than anyone else in the world above street level. And that's because everybody lives in these very tall apartment blocks. And that's a consequence of just incredible population density. Okay, well, we could obviously carry on, and it's something to think about, especially when you travel and you visit other places. Think about the ways in which they vary. Make this an explicit part of your agenda when you visit places. How is this different? And what are the subtle ways it's different? An interesting subtle way in which countries differ, and this would go under one little tiny corner of culture, is how far apart are people comfortable in talking to each other? And I'm sure some of the international students who are here have experienced this issue. In some cultures, some places, you can really talk nose to nose. You know, you talk, which in the United States would be really talking in your face. But that's the normative, comfortable way to talk. In other places, you have to be quite distant. There was an interesting study of the United Nations where somebody did a video from above a kind of international gathering at the United Nations that was kind of like a cocktail party. And you could see people moving in pairs when there would be somebody from a close nose-to-nose culture talking to somebody from a further away culture. And the person from the farther away culture was constantly scooting back, and the person from the close-up culture was constantly moving forward, so people would move through the space. All right. Well, that's all fun. Let's get down to serious business. Well, all of this is discussed in some detail in this introductory chapter. This is really a stage-setting chapter of the book. You know, this is to kind of set the agenda for all of the much more detailed discussions of particular ways that the United States varies from other countries and how to understand that variation that we will encounter throughout the book and throughout the semester. But I think it's still good to briefly go through this broader inventory of characteristics. So let me just make brief comments about each of them. First of all, technology. If you were dropped down in some time and place, unknown to you, blindfolded, without being able to hear or smell anything in your environment, and you had to ask one question to a person in order to get your bearings, to get some sense of what kind of a place were you in, what sort of society had you been plunked down in, and you could only ask one question. A really good candidate for that question would be, well, what's the mix of technologies that you use to provide for your needs? Technology, it's not that technology is necessarily in all aspects of life the most important determinant. It's not that it's always the most important. But there are very big ramifications for the lives of people in a society simply by virtue of what are the dominant technologies available to people. Technologies can be evaluated in terms of three main criteria there are many others, but here are three important criteria. First, productivity, which simply means how much time and resources does it take to produce something. You have a very productive technology if it doesn't take much time and resource to produce whatever you're producing. You have a less productive technology if it takes a lot of time and resources. In 1750, it took over 1,400 times as long to spin a given amount of yarn as it does today. And just think about it. I think the figure that I have is 1,430 times longer to spin a yard of yarn in 1750 than it does today. Agriculture just is fantastic for explaining this. At the time of the American Revolution, it took over half the population in the United States to produce enough food for the entire population. Right? So in order for everybody to eat, half of the population had to spend their time producing food. Now, that still means that half of the population didn't have to produce food in order to eat, which means that in the agricultural sector, you could produce more food than is needed just to feed the people in agriculture. Right? So that still indicates significant productivity. But compare that to the United States today. There are 319 million people in the United States today, 2017. I think it's 318.9 million, but 319 million people. And less than 3% of the population produces food. And not only that, we export more food than we import. So actually, 3% of the population in the United States produces more food than is necessary to feed 319 million people. It's astounding, the increase in the level of productivity. And that means that 97% of the population is able to do other things besides producing food. Now, there may be some problems with this. There's certainly issues which we will discuss about agribusiness and about the priorities of food industry to get people to eat lots of sugar. Along with this productivity comes power and interests, and there may be all sorts of distortions in the nature of the agro-food sector that imposes harms on people. I think the recent revelations about how the sugar industry repressed research and paid Harvard scientists to say that sugar was good for you. I mean, it's pretty gross when you see these recent studies about the history of the sugar industry and how it's pushed sugar and how much sugar is contained in our food system. And sugar, I think, the current evidence indicates sugar in excess quantities is really harmful to your health. It's not just its empty calories, it's actually bad for you. Well, there's all sorts of negative things that have come along with this huge increase in productivity, but the productivity itself is a positive thing. We could not live the lives we live in the absence of highly productive agriculture. It's something to be celebrated, even if there are criticisms to be raised about particular organizational features. Costs and economies of scale. That's another interesting feature of technologies. Are technologies cheap or expensive? Economies of scale is a really interesting idea. Economies of scale. It means that it's much cheaper to produce any given item if you produce lots of them than if you produce only a few. It's kind of obvious for some things, like automobiles. If you set up a factory to produce 10 automobiles a year, each one is going to cost a lot more than if you set up a factory to produce 100,000 automobiles a year. Because there are fixed costs of setting it up, of getting all the engineering right, of getting the production machinery all organized properly. Those are all fixed costs, and if you can distribute those costs over 100,000 automobiles, then each unit is cheaper. That's economies of scale. One of the reasons why in certain sectors you have very large firms and very large factories in certain sectors is because of economies of scale, because it's cheaper to produce each item if you produce a lot of them. What's interesting in the present era, and this is really one of the things which justify what some people describe as the third technological revolution, you know, beyond the Industrial Revolution, is that in many sectors, economies of scale are declining, not increasing. Just think about what the internet does for publishing. You know, it's possible to publish a book online now in which it's not all that more efficient to, well, you produce one online, and then whether one person downloads it or a million people download it, the marginal cost of downloading is the same. Publishing has become way cheaper than it used to be. And the result has been an increase, not a decrease, in the number of books that are published a year, because it's much, much cheaper to produce books now than it used to be. That's also true for printed books, not just for online books. The setup costs for a book now are very, very low. By the time an author submits their final manuscript in digital form, as a Word document, what it takes for the publisher to actually turn that into the files that get actually printed is just a fraction, a tiny fraction of what it costs to typeset it. And because it costs so little to turn the manuscript into a published version, the per unit costs of publishing are much lower. Finally, we can think about technology in terms of the impact on people's lives. Think about three different ways in which you could produce physical objects. One way of producing it is craft work. Individual producers using their own tools and machines to produce an object. A second way is the assembly line. Mass production, the classic mass production of the high industrial era. And a third way is the automated robotic production system. These are three different ways of producing sometimes the very same objects. But the impact on people's lives are very different from being a person producing using craft labor versus being an assembly line worker versus being a manager of robots. Now, robots are not self-repairing, and they are not self-activating. Robots still need people, but the kinds of tasks involved in being a robot specialist in an automobile industry is very different from being an assembly line worker in a classic automobile assembly line. And both of those are vastly different from being a craft worker in the pre-assembly line period. That, I think, is the one way of thinking about the impact of technology on people's lives. So here's the key theme. So technology is one way that societies vary. We are a very high productivity economy using very advanced forms of technology. Sometimes we're at the leading edge of that, sometimes we're not, but we're certainly among the societies within which technological change is occurring at a very rapid pace. The US has achieved extraordinary levels of productivity that open up huge human possibilities. But, and here is the critical point, and a point that we'll be discussing at various times, the use of this productivity to actually enhance the overall well-being of people is undermined by our institutions. I think automation and the elimination of the assembly line is a good thing. It's a great thing to replace the drudgery of the endlessly, you know, turning the same crank on an assembly line, the repetitive, dull work of an assembly line by robots. It liberates human time for more interesting things. But if it liberates people from the world of work by putting them into unemployment, well, that's a problem. It's a failure of the use of technology if the way we use our productivity displaces people from access to meaningful livelihoods, rather than liberates their time for more creative and interesting things to do. That's technology, then. Second item on our list, the economy. We're going to spend quite a bit of time on this, so I don't need to dwell on it too much in this first foray into the topic. The thing to remember, here's the kind of big idea, if you want to flag a big idea. The kind of economy in which we live, which can be broadly called a capitalist economy, is only one particular way of organizing economic activity. It's historically actually quite novel. Capitalism as a system, as a way of organizing an entire economy, as being the kind of core of an economic system, capitalism is really only a couple of hundred years old. Its roots began in the late medieval, early modern period. It coexisted with all sorts of non-capitalist ways of organizing economic activity for a couple of hundred years, and it gradually became dominant in the course of the 19th century. It's a relatively new phenomenon in human history, a capitalist economy. Capitalism is therefore contrasted with a variety of other kinds of economic systems. Just to give you the names of a few alternatives, it's different from a slave system, it's different from feudalism, it's different from a state-run economy. Capitalism is a kind of market economy, but it's not the same as a market economy. There are non-capitalist forms of market economies. Capitalism is just one type of market economy. And furthermore, there are many kinds of capitalism. Capitalism is not just one type of economy. There are all sorts of ways in which capitalism itself vary. There are highly competitive forms of capitalism, and there are capitalisms dominated by giant corporations with huge accumulations of power. Those are both capitalist, but they're very different in the way they work. Well, we will be, again, discussing this in detail beginning next week, but just to give you the sort of stripped down definition of capitalism, capitalism is a way of organizing an economy in which production is for the market. You're not just producing to meet your own needs like a subsistence farmer does. You're producing for other people. You're producing for a market. Enterprises are privately owned and run for profit. The purpose of an enterprise is to generate more income than it takes to produce the things it produces. It wants to generate a profit. That's the motivation for producing for the market. And people who do not own their own enterprises earn their living by working as employees for privately owned firms. Thus, there's a labor market in capitalism. You could have the first two, production for the market and production oriented towards profit, without having capitalism, if, for example, the owners of the firms also owned the laborers. That's what the American Plantation South was. It was not fundamentally a capitalist economy in the South because there was no market in labor. The workers on the plantation were owned just like the machinery was owned by the slave owners, by the plantation owners. In a capitalist economy, the market is at the center. Owners of capital and owners of labor meet in the market, engage in exchange, and production is organized through that. Now, it's not enough to say that the United States is capitalist. We also need to have some idea of what kind of capitalism. Many ways we could describe this. I think it's useful to emphasize how deeply capitalist we are. We are, if you had a spectrum of countries and you want to say where is the most capitalistic and where is the least capitalistic economy, where capitalist principles are the most dominant and pervasive, the United States is certainly one of the countries that's way off on the hyper-capitalist extreme. It's a capitalism made up of powerful, gigantic corporations. There's a nice chart, this is in the book, which illustrates how big the US corporations are. If you took the 10 largest corporations in the United States and called them a country, they would be the eighth richest country in the world, the eighth largest economy in the world, between Brazil and Russia. Just the top 10 private US corporations. And this is 2008 data. I checked. I couldn't get a 2016 list of the same sort, but the most recent list, it's very similar. This hasn't changed much. So we have powerful, gigantic corporations. We are among the capitalist countries in which we have relatively weak unions. If you think of capitalist firms as having two kinds of investors, there's investors of capital and there's investors of labor. That's what employees do. They invest their labor. Investors of capital form huge combines. We call them giant corporations. They pool their capital to make possible these hugely powerful entities. We don't make it very easy for the labor to pool their investment, which is what labor unions are. Labor unions are the association of investors of labor in firms. We have weak unions compared to most other capitalist countries. We also have relatively weak public regulation of markets. Now, there's a lot of complaint in the United States on the conservative side of the political spectrum about how over-regulated American firms are. Well, they may be. I mean, this doesn't imply that those criticisms aren't correct, but we're certainly not over-regulated compared to other countries. We have among the least regulated markets and the least regulated corporate behavior of any contemporary comparable capitalist countries. And we're also in the capitalist world, among the countries with the lowest levels of taxation. Again, taxes could conceivably be too high, even though we're among the lowest. But we can't make the argument that our taxes are too high because it puts us at a competitive disadvantage with other countries, since in virtually all other capitalist countries, rates of taxation are significantly higher than they are here. That's an issue we will look at in some detail later. Economic inequality, the third item on the list. Here's the key theme. The United States has the highest levels of economic inequality and poverty of all developed economies. Around 23% of children are poor in the United States compared to 5 to 15% in other comparably rich countries. The richest 1% of households have 114 times more wealth than the median household. Huge inequalities in wealth. And things have gotten much worse or better if you like inequality. They've certainly gotten much more unequal in the past three decades. The United States is highly unequal. Now, we will be spending a fair amount of time thinking through this problem in the middle of the course. That's the second block in the course, is about inequality and fairness and how to think about inequality. There are arguments that inequality is a good thing because it generates incentives and it rewards risk-taking. There's all sorts of reasons why some degree of inequality could be beneficial, and why absolute equality, the idea that you could actually completely eliminate economic inequality, the costs of doing so, even if in your fantasy life you thought it might be a good world, the cost of doing so could be prohibitive. But it's one thing to say that some inequality creates incentives and rewards risk-taking, and another thing to say that the level of inequality that we currently have in the United States is good for the society and is something which should not be criticized and should not be remedied. Well, that's a theme we will be spending a lot of time talking about in the future. This, by the way, just triggered something I meant to say at the beginning. So, okay, this is a little complete digression from the flow of the lecture, but I do want to have it out. At the end of the class last time, a student came up to me and said that he was a pretty conservative person in his political views, and he was concerned that in the grading of the course he might be at a disadvantage. And I just want to assure all of you, this is 100% guarantee, you know, not a 94% guarantee, it's 100% guarantee. There is no penalty whatsoever for your political views in this class. On the exams, the exams will be short answer exams. Mostly they're just asking you to describe different perspectives on things. So just as an example, when we discuss poverty, we will be exploring two different general ways people think about how do we explain poverty. And those two different types of explanations sometimes are characterized as blame the victim and blame society. And a question that's appeared on some exams in the past has been, give a brief description of the blame society and blame the victim view of poverty, and give arguments for and against each of them. Right? So, a question like that, I think, can be answered by a liberal or conservative student equally well, because you have to know what is said in the blame the victim and blame society views, and you have to know what the strengths and weaknesses of each are. And surely I want every one of you who think of yourself as liberals to know what the arguments why blame the victim is reasonable. What's the rational kernel? What's the aspect of those arguments that do make sense? Now, my own view is that blame society has the weight of the evidence, that that's the explanation for why we have so much poverty and other countries don't. It's much more to do with our institutions than with the character of our people. But you need to know both arguments. And the exam is not going to privilege one perspective over another, in the sense that if you happen to agree with the more conservative view, you will be penalized on the exam. And if it should happen that there's something in the way you answered it, and you feel your diagnosis as to why you missed points was that it was political bias, then that's something to object to. I mean, it may be that you were just confused about your answer. You know, it's possible, but it has nothing to do with politics. But it could. Accidents, mistakes happen, and it's a legitimate basis for objecting. So everybody should feel relaxed about that. Back to the lecture. Political institutions. This is what we'll be talking about mostly in the third part of the course. The United States has a democratic form of government, but it is a relatively thin democracy. As a society, we spend more on political competition than any other country in the world, and yet this yields only a thin form of democracy. Now, there's a lot to be elaborated there. That first of all, the claim that we have a thin form of democracy, that has to be argued for. That's not just something to be taken for granted. And once we have established that that's descriptively correct, that is that there are many other countries that are more deeply democratic than we are, we have to figure out why. And then, most crucially, we have to think about the question, what sorts of changes would make for a more robust democracy? Democracy is a relatively new form of governance of the state, although there are some ancient roots, as I think many of you probably know, in Athens 3,000 years or so ago. In Athens, they did have a democratic form of government among free males. Women were excluded and slaves were excluded. But among the male non-slave population, the free population, they did have a particular form of democracy. It turns out that that was also, I think, an extremely interesting form of democracy. The way in which legislators and executives were chosen was by random selection. People were chosen to be officials in government the same way we choose jurors to sit on a jury. That's called a sortition legislature. Sortition is the term used to describe the way in which public officials were chosen in ancient Athens. And I think it's a pretty interesting idea. It's something that I'm actually working on in my own academic work, is the idea, what would it be like if we replaced one of the legislative chambers in the state of Wisconsin? What if we replaced the Senate with a randomly selected citizens' assembly? So you'd have an elected assembly of politicians and parties and a citizens' assembly, rather than two party-based chambers. It's a pretty interesting idea. You know, just think in your head, would that be an improvement? Would that make for a more interesting, well, it would certainly be a more interesting democracy. Would it make for a more democratic democracy? Or would it just create chaos? Well, that's the kind of problem that I work on in my professional academic work. And I think it's a nice idea just to think about as a thought experiment. The military and global power. The United States really stands alone in the world today. It's in a unique position. It may not be the same kind of unequivocal superpower that it might have been at some earlier period, perhaps, but there is no question that we have more military power than any other single country, and actually probably more than the rest of the world combined. The United States is a relatively militaristic society and has generally adopted a militarily aggressive policy internationally. As a descriptive fact, so this is not an interpretive point, the United States has intervened militarily in more countries since World War II than any other nation. That is, we have invaded more countries than any other country has since World War II. Now, that may be a good thing. You know, there are arguments why it's a good thing for the United States to be the world's policeman and to intervene globally whenever we think it's in our interest to do so, and to do so unilaterally in many cases, including cases where we intervene to overthrow democratic governments. There's arguments that are made as to why this is desirable. I'm very critical of such global interventionism, but it is a characteristic of our country, for better or worse. On the spectrum of militarism, we are a highly militaristic government, and I would argue a militaristic society as well. Military values, military sensibilities, the kind of aggressive posture that militarism represents has more pervasive implications than just a policy that's pursued by the national government. Gender. This is a big theme that we'll be having a couple of sessions on, but I think is just incredibly interesting. And it's one of the themes that we'll be talking about which bears most powerfully in the lives of everyone in this room. we are living in the midst of the most dynamic and rapid transformation of gender relations in human history. Indeed, I think one could almost make an even stronger claim. The speed and depth with which gender relations have been transformed in the last half century is the most rapid change in fundamental social relations of any kind, not just gender, in human history. If you look at what was the standard normative form of male-female relations 100 years ago and compare it to now, it's just a deep and pervasive transformation, and one which I think is irreversible. Now, that's an interesting question. There's some wonderful science fiction stories and other novels which talk about which challenge this, that say that we could return to a form of male domination and unequivocal patriarchy, that this is possible, that this hasn't been destroyed once and for all. There's a novel by Margaret Atwood called The Handmaid's Tale, really chilling novel, which is basically about the defeat of women's liberation, the final defeat of women's emancipation. In the United States, it results in a kind of underground railroad for women to escape to Canada. It's a good story. I mean, I don't think it's plausible, but it's a terrific novel. Social cleavage, race. Racial inequality and racial cleavage remains a deep and serious reality of American life, in spite of the very real progress in the last half century. The dilemmas we face around racial cleavage are extremely sharp and difficult. And this is one of the issues we will discuss, I hope, in a subtle and serious way in the middle part of the course, where we talk about fairness and equality. Immigration. This is really a cliche. I mean, you all know the cliche, we are a nation of immigrants. It's important to know that there was no such thing in the United States as an illegal immigrant until the 1920s, except for a few very special categories. There was a specific law banning Chinese immigration in the 1880s, I believe. So there were specific exclusion acts. But certainly, broadly speaking, those of us whose ancestors came from Europe didn't need to get visas. They just showed up on Ellis Island or on some other particular way of coming into the United States. You did not need permission to enter the United States until roughly 100 years ago. Periodically, our history has been marked by what are called nativist backlashes against immigrants. So the hostility towards illegal immigrants that we are observing today is not new. They weren't illegal, they were just immigrants in the 19th century. There was a huge backlash against the Irish in the 19th century. I'm sure many of you come from Irish ancestry. It's one of the kind of big cultural sources of America, of our pluralistic culture, comes from the Irish influence. Well, Irish were despised in parts of the country in the middle of the 19th century. In the early 20th century, there was a nativist backlash against Eastern and Southern European immigrants. And it was the backlash against those populations that really triggered the extreme restrictions of immigration that marked the middle decades of the 20th century. And now we have similar kind of nativist opposition to Hispanic immigration. Culture. What do we mean by culture? Culture are shared patterns of beliefs and values. Culture also includes other things like customs, cuisine, music, dance, senses of humor. There's all sorts of other things that get packaged into culture. But you can think of it broadly as beliefs, values, and other aspects of a person's identity. Here are some important aspects of American culture. First of all, we are, broadly speaking, a pluralistic society that tolerates, and often with enthusiasm, not just begrudgingly, tolerates diversity of cultural forms. Just think of what might be the array of coherent subcultures, things that we think of as subcultures, that are not just put up with, but kind of celebrated as part of the interesting diversity. Amish communities, urban cosmopolitans, southern traditionalists, educated highbrows and NASCAR sports fans. Just think about music, country music, hip-hop, easy listening, and opera. Some people are omnivores. They have come to develop a kind of cultural pluralism within themselves, not just in their appreciation of the society at large. I myself am a great fan of opera and don't have much of a taste for country music, but my niece is just a complete fanatic about both, and in a delightful way, and she kind of fantasizes a full-bore country music opera. By and large, this pluralism exists in a broader culture of tolerance. Mostly, people feel it's a good thing to have this much diversity. There are currents in the United States which are not tolerant. For example, when people say, we are a Christian nation and that should be official. You know, it shouldn't be just one's view that this is a part of our heritage that is extremely important, but we should be defined formally as a Christian nation. That is a pretty hostile way of thinking about religious pluralism towards people who have other faiths and for people who are secularists who don't have any religious identification at all. I don't think that's the dominant current. I think even many people who say that actually still are tolerant. You know, there's often a difference between what people want to say for symbolic affirmation of some sort, if they're feeling under threat, and what they actually would like to see in the world. But there is a current of intolerance in the United States at the cultural level. I'm not talking about other forms of intolerance, cultural intolerance. Individualism. Well, this is what we're often told is at the heart of American culture. We're rugged individualists. And it's probably true that compared to most other places, people value their own individual autonomy, not being told what to do, the aspiration to be your own boss, all these kinds of things, the notion that nobody's going to tell me what to do, that sort of idea of placing the individual rather than the community or the society at the center of one's concern. It's probably true that individualism does rank higher as a cultural feature in the United States than most places. But I think it's a mistake to think that Americans don't also deeply value community. We do. Most people feel their identities are tied to some kind of community. And particularly when there are periods of crisis and challenge, people band together in solidarity with those communities. Religiosity, that was mentioned as one of the independent dimensions. The United States is, by almost every measure, the most religious country among the developed countries of the world today. A very large proportion of Americans profess a belief in God. The estimates range from somewhere around 75% to 90%. It depends a bit upon how the questions are asked, and of course, surveys always have some, you know, error because of the samples and so on. One can roughly think that somewhere between 80 and 90% of Americans profess a belief in God. This is much higher than in any other comparable country. You know, a typical European country, it'll be less than 50%. According to a Gallup poll in 1914, 40% of Americans don't believe in evolution. So biological evolution of the species, which is, I think, not in dispute scientifically. I don't think there's any credible arguments against it. only 60% of Americans believe in scientific evolution. 40% deny it. That's pretty astounding. You know, it's a very high rejection of science as a form of knowledge. And that's what it is. I mean, to not believe in evolution is not merely to hold religious beliefs, it's to reject science as a way of understanding the world. And that's an important part of American culture, and a part that we have to contend with. We have to understand what are the social bases, what are the cultural roots of this, why is it that science is so deeply rejected in such a high-tech, economically dynamic economy and world as we live in. Finally, as a cultural aspect in the United States, we are a highly commercialized and consumerist society. This is something we'll talk about quite a bit later in the course. Commercial forms of culture, especially consumerism, play a bigger role here than in any other country. This underwrites the fact that Americans save less and buy more things on credit than in any other country. Shopping is a recreational activity. Shopping malls in the United States are sites of culture because that's where people find meaning. Success in the market is the success of status. Keeping up with the Joneses is a major motivation for getting ahead rather than simply providing for a decent life for yourself and your family. Well, we're out of time. I will tack on the last bit of this as we begin our substantive discussion of the economy in the next lecture. See you next week.